Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with Michelle Gewirtz of the Ottawa Art Gallery. We're talking about their exhibit, A Window on Peresquiva Clark, which goes until May 29th, my birthday. Enjoy. We're still in the process of lining up sponsors for Let's Talk Art with Brooke, but in the meantime, if you'd like to support the podcast, please buy my book, Reptiles on Caffeine, on Amazon. Enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm talking with Michelle Gewirtz about the Peresquiva Clark exhibit. It's actually called A Window on Peresquiva Clark in the Ottawa Art Gallery, all the way in Ottawa, Canada. Hey, Michelle, how you doing?
Hi, I'm well, thanks. How are you, Brooke?
Doing good. So tell me about Peresquiva Clark exhibit. Who is she?
Sure, Peresquiva Clark.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
Well, people pronounce it in all kinds of creative ways, and I've often second-guessed myself to make sure that I'm pronouncing it correctly. So Peresquiva Clark was an artist who was born in Russia, mm-hmm. in St. Petersburg in 1898, and she emigrated to Canada in 1931, but by way of Paris. So my first sort of encounter with her was in a sort of, I suppose, atypical way, in that I used to go to auction houses with my parents a lot of the time, and her work used to sell really well at auctions, and I was very interested in art and learning the history of art, as you do in sort of high school art classes and then right. university. And so I learned about, you know, she's sort of known in the canon of Canadian art history as a very outspoken woman with communist leanings who mm-hmm. agitated in a very conservative art milieu in Toronto in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so when I encountered her work, she was selling very well, and so I saw her work that way, and then as I was learning, you learn about her in this very kind of narrow mm-hmm. way, because it is literally... She painted this painting that's in the National Gallery of Canada called Petrushka. It's a very interesting painting. It's actually about an event that took place in Chicago in 1937, a steelworkers' mm-hmm. strike. Mm-hmm. And it offers, I mean, a very playful but sort of allegorical critique of robber baron or big baron capitalism at the time. I mean, the 30s was in the height of the Depression, and so here was this woman, Russian woman, an immigrant painting in Canada, and so she's, which is very contrary to the kind of art that was being produced by her contemporaries, and so, so that is generally how she is known. But with this, with my research, which then really kind of deepened that. So this exhibition is actually kind of a cabinet exhibition, I suppose, drawn from my doctoral thesis, mm-hmm. So I got to, you know, work and learn and look at lots of work and realize that there was a, you know, much more nuanced story to tell here, which is why in this exhibition, A Window on Peresquiva Clark, I really tried to sort of shift the view of her away from, to sort of give a more fulsome picture, I suppose, of her life and her career and working in Canada. And so the mm-hmm. collection at the Ottawa Art Gallery has allowed me to do that.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So when did she emigrate to Canada?
She emigrated to Canada in 1931, but not directly from Russia, where she was born. So she, the other bits of the story, I mean, one of the things about Peresquiva Clark is that, as I suppose you could argue for most artists, but I mean, her in particular, she lived a life of contradiction. So in this sort of general narrative, she's known as this working class woman who emigrated here because she married a Canadian named Philip Clark, who was mm-hmm. an accountant. Uh-huh. And she growing up where she did in St. Petersburg, she grew up in a sort of factory or industrial area, right. but she wasn't quite working class. I mean, her family was of a working class background, but sort of the learned or upwardly mobile, I suppose, mm-hmm. would maybe be the way to describe it. And then, of course, 1917, the Russian Revolution happens and everything changes. Mm-hmm. And this is what allowed her to pursue art training, mm-hmm. Which she did in the Free Suit Studios, or the SFOMAs. And so then she was working, she went through training and trained with some fairly notable people in that kind of system, and then got a job working as a set decorator for a theater company. And she got married to a man named Oreste Allegri Jr. And she had a child with him, and his family, they were prominent theater designers. They were an Italian family, but they had theaters in Moscow. The one that she worked in with her husband was called the Mali Theater, and which was then Petrograd, which the city changed names after the revolution. It became Leningrad under communism, and then has been recently switched back to St. Petersburg. And so, and then they were also affiliated with Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe. So they were sort of working in between Paris and Moscow and Petrograd. And so she was sort of married into this very artsy and well-connected family. And then unfortunately her husband died in a drowning accident. They had been married, I think, for less than a year. And yeah, so she, and they had a 3-month-old son. So, but this, yes, so she then was left a young widow. I think she was 24 years old, or 23, somewhere in there. And she was faced, you know, she was trying to survive, and it because her in-laws, you know, were I think it was easier for her to have a nice life or to forge a living, really. Maybe not a, that's maybe not the best way to describe it. But she, eventually she and her young son emigrated from Russia to Paris, where they were working. And she actually, in order to earn her keep, worked as a sales girl in a department store type place. It was called Maison D.I.M. in the 1920s in Paris. So she spent a decade in Paris. And it was there that she met Philip Clark. He was traveling with a friend, Maria Daskin, who was a well-known musician and with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. And Philip Clark was an accountant, and he walked into a shop, and she tried to sell him something, and he asked her out on a date.
And they fell in love.
They had a year of writing letters to each other, and so that's how she. They actually were married in 1931. So this 29. I think was when they met in Paris, and there was a year or so of correspondence. He came back to Paris and agreed to. Eventually, he did adopt her first or her son with the first husband, Ben Clark, and they were married in London, and then traveled back to Canada, a married couple, and that is how she ended up here. And to make her mark, and it's she always attributed, she said, you know, the kinds of work that she painted, had she had a career in Paris, had she remained in Europe, nobody would have noticed, because the type of work that she was producing was very much in line with a lot of that sort of modernist European, you know, work that was inflected by trends that were happening certainly in Russia, but she was very influenced by Cézanne. And whereas when she came to Canada, people weren't working in that vein at all. So this sort of singled her out and made her unusual. So she really credited that move to Canada to really making the conditions a possibility for her to become an artist, which is also what I tried to highlight in the exhibition.
Cool.
Yeah.
So didn't I read that she was a commercial artist for a time?
She was indeed, even though she, so when I was saying she sort of lived a life of contradictions, because she's most known for being kind of a communist agitator and very anti-capitalist. And there's a wonderful film that was made by the National Film Board of Canada when they used to have a feminist film division called Studio D. And so a filmmaker by the name of Gail Singer, who's a wonderful person and a great filmmaker, made this film in 1982 called Portrait of the Artist as an Old Lady, which is a fabulous film.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, we should lobby the NFB to digitize it and put it on their website.
Yeah, totally.
we have a copy playing in the gallery, in the exhibition. But,
nice.
So in the beginning, she's railing, Periskeva is railing against capitalists, which is ironic because, yes, she did for a time work as a commercial artist. And that's sort of what I used just to springboard this idea of taking a different view, mm-hmm. At looking at, you know, a somewhat known artist in the history of Canadian art, although I suppose when you're talking about Canadian art and canon and then women in particular, all those things, I don't know how well known she is outside of certain circles, but
right. This is the first I've heard of her, honestly.
Yes, I'm not surprised to hear that. And she sort of later on dismissed, you know, oh, this was just some commercial work that I did, but I was really trying to take a look at, you know, that artists were and still continue to contribute to cultural life generally. And one of the ways that that happens is by doing commissions for companies. And in this case, the Timothy Eaton Company, Timothy Eaton was the company was the largest department store chain in Canada, and they had built this very, Art Deco department store, sort of along the lines, if you watch, you know, Mr. Selfridge or something like that. Mm-hmm. But actually, before the Depression, the plans, the architectural plans for this building, which is now known as College Park, but it was the Carlew, they were very ambitious. It was going to be the largest skyscraper in North America. But then, course, the Depression hit, and those plans were derailed.
Right.
But they were still left with this beautiful building with 10 feet, long windows. I think the windows were, sort of like Macy's department store type, or in Chicago, there's the famous department store there. But so that, windows and window displays were really a thing. And a designer by the name of René Serra was commissioned by the company to sort of create a Canadian modernist or very fashionable kind of aesthetic. And he hired a number of artists to help him do that. So Paris Gaba was one of those artists, and she painted scene paintings probably that were quite similar to the work that she had done when she was working in Russia. And for her, it was, a way in to sort of to meet other artists who were up and coming in Toronto at that time. And, she was very serious and self-consciously wanted to have a career as a working artist. So,
cool.
So, yeah, she worked as a commercial artist.
Yeah, she kind of, so she sold out for a bit.
She did a little bit and then denied it later. She minimized it later. But, she was always very open that, art is hard work and
exactly.
You have to work in order to make,
totally.
Make a living and make ends meet. And,
totally. I was just kidding.
No.
No, I'm totally for that. I had a career in graphic design for a little bit, so that's kind of why she intrigued me a little bit. cool. So tell me what your process was, your curatorial process with this was, when you got the idea. How do you put it together? How you just kind of how you curated it, basically?
Sure. It's a good question, and I'm glad you asked it, because it really has to do with my role here at the Ottawa Art Gallery as the interim senior curator. So the Ottawa Art Gallery is in Canada's national capital. We're not the national gallery. I often get mistaken for working there, but we're a municipal gallery that's actually in the midst of expanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was hired I was invited to curate the show, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I had written a very small portion of my thesis on the work that Paris Gaba Clark had done through Eaton's, but it wasn't really something that I had focused on. But because I landed here at this time of, kind of reinvigoration of the arts, or, this big building campaign, and actually right across the street, we're located across the street from Ottawa's largest downtown shopping mall, with the process of being renovated. So as I was curating, I was watching a sort of gentrification or a revitalization of the downtown, where Ogilvy's, which was the sort of opulent department store, it was a chain in Montreal, but very similar to the Timothy Eaton Company. The building, the 1920s building that still butts on Rideau Street, which is sort of the main shopping area, I suppose, near here. And it's being reinstalled brick by brick.
Uh-huh.
So I sort of thought, well, I knew that these drawings were in the Firestone collection of Canadian art. And the Firestone collection actually is quite an interesting collection. And its history nicely kind of mirrors the history of the Ottawa Art Gallery. Mm-hmm. So it was a collection that was amassed here in Ottawa by a family, the Firestone family, who at one time they were the owners of the son, I believe, was the owner of the Ottawa Senators, which is a hockey team. And
cool.
Canada has the center around hockey, but got that one in there.
Yeah.
But they amassed this really significant collection of Canadian art. And one of the other interesting aspects of the way that they collected was they really made a point of trying to collect a work from, you know, that would capture sort of every year or every phase of an artist's career. So as opposed to a collector just going and saying, well, I really want the best, you know, Jackson Pollock or Lauren Harris or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I really want these key examples. They were actually... I mean, obviously they wanted the nice stuff, but they were really interested in how artists worked and that sort of career progression and process. So I took a look at the holdings of Paris Gava's work in the Ottawa Art Gallery's collection, in the Firestone collection of Canadian art, and there were a lot of preparatory drawings. And I mean, so I thought, well, I'd like to do sort of three things. One, to sort of shift the narrative as opposed to, you know, the two or three works that she is now known for because they get shown a lot, and to show what, you know, these preparatory drawings against some of the finished works, which, you know, in a lot of cases we had drawings, but I knew from my doctoral research and other things, you know, who owned matching or who owned the finished pieces if the Firestones hadn't collected them themselves, if they'd only collected the drawings. And then I also thought, well, this aspect, like this, you know, very early in her career, right when she arrived in Canada in 31, she starts working for the Timothy Eaton Company in 1934, 35, and she works for them for a period of about 5 years and produced, on average, 4 to 5 window displays a year. And some of these were really, I mean, 10-foot long canvases.
Yeah.
So not a lot of that work survives, but I was able to. So the Firestones had 3 working drawings, and then I was able to locate 2 other drawings that were in the Eaton's department store themselves. Unfortunately, those ones don't. The process drawings don't match, but I still thought, well, you know, it allowed me to actually give a much more fulsome view of the life and the working life, anyways, of this particular artist.
Right.
So that's kind of how I went about approaching this one.
Cool. Yeah. That sounds awesome. And she sounds really interesting.
Yeah. She's quite a character. I mean, we really should start some sort of campaign to get the National Film Board of Canada to, they have a lot of their stuff digitized and you can watch, but not that particular film.
Not that one.
And yeah, Paris Gava was very, you know, she was a small woman, but she was, you know, very outspoken throughout her life. She wrote a polemical text, actually, in 1937, where she really tried to, you know, encourage others to use art in the same way that, you know, she thought art, or she was using her art, which was to really to get people to be socially and politically engaged and to not paint kind of these pretty, you know, landscape pictures or still, I mean, which artists, you know, continue, and there's nothing wrong with painting those.
Right, they have their place.
But, you know, I think particularly in these volatile political times, you know, in the late 30s and then after the outbreak of the war, that she really felt that art and artists had a more important role to play in society. So she was quite outspoken and, you know, it is, if you do get a chance to listen to or see recordings or see her art, there's a lot of that definitely that comes through. So that's always a nice thing to be able to show to the public. And it's fortunate, you know, I think it's a nice feature of the exhibition that we have the film playing on an iPad.
Yeah.
So it's not sort of, you know, labels and me interpreting the work, but you have her at a time in her life where she's looking back and then talking, you know, to a lot of people. And I think some of the work that she is in the background of this film, I managed to get my hands on. So
cool.
But, yeah.
So
one little
I like that. I think that's very cool. So what's the reception been?
It's been phenomenal, actually. It's always sort of a bit of a gambit when you're talking about historical art. It poses its own challenge. Mm-hmm. And particularly sort of recovering or doing these kinds of like feminist recovery projects. Mm-hmm. And the response has been, I've been really pleased with it. We've gotten a lot of visitors in and a lot of attention and a lot of good coverage. And, I mean, for me, the real kind of cherry on the cake, I guess, was when her family, came to the opening, and right away they just said it was so nice, it was so refreshing to see something different.
Oh, her family came?
Yeah, they did. Her granddaughter, Paris Gava Clark's granddaughter, Panya Clark Espinal, is an artist herself, and she and her husband were really so generous in terms of sharing not only their work but their insights, into in that case her grandmother's practice, and but also really letting me kind of develop my own interpretations. But yes, they came to the opening. Actually, a whole gang of them. So cool. They have a son, her son that she with Clive Clark. So that was her son with Philip Clark, her second son, and his wife, and their two daughters came, and there were I think three great granddaughters of Paris Gavis. So they were all here. And that was really nice to.
That's huge.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
And actually the other nice moment was I did an event with Charlie Hill, who had retired only I think last fall, but he was one of the senior curators of Canadian art at the National Gallery of Canada for I think 40 some odd years.
Oh wow!
And he and I had a nice little public conversation, but it was fun to find out that he didn't know actually about this aspect of Paris Gavis.
Ah, so you went up to him. That's awesome.
He was very generous, so I'm sure I'm very indebted to his work. It's true. He actually, there was an exhibition that happened at the National Gallery in 1973 called Canadian Painting in the 30s, and he put Paris Gava Clark's self-portrait on the cover, and that move, because by that time she had fallen somewhat into obscurity for several reasons, and I think that move really, I said to him during this conversation, it was like, that move sort of caused, there's a whole younger generation of art historians and curators and scholars, I think, that have looked at Paris Gava Clark in various contexts, and I think had that exhibition or had that choice not been made, then a lot of this other work would either have been slower to emerge or, may not have happened at all. So.
Right, right.
I might have went up to him, but I'm also pretty indebted to him.
Yeah. But having one up to him had to have been kind of satisfying.
It was.
So what's next for the Ottawa Art Gallery? What other stuff's going on?
We've got lots of exciting stuff going on because we are in the midst of this big expansion. So we're a gallery we showcase a lot of contemporary art. We're mandated, to focus on a lot of what happens regionally, but because we're moving into a new space, which will be five times the size of where we currently are, I think that is going to allow for all kinds of exciting partnerships, and, we can circulate work by Ottawa artists across the country and partner with organizations, internationally, and vice versa. So, and we've actually done that at the moment with, we have a show on that was guest curated by an artist named Brad Isaacs. It's called All That You Touch, and it features seven Aboriginal artists working across a range of media and also across the continent, because we have Autumn Chacon, who's a sound-based and visual artist activist, mm-hmm. and she's based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Ursula Johnson, who has done a fabulous, she's made a jacket out of birch bark. It looks like it took her 300 hours.
And I was going to say, like, how do you do that?
I don't know. It's an incredible object, and I hope that it gets shown in a lot of places. And she sort of, it's a very tongue-in-cheek, it's a reference to another Canadian artist named Ken Monkman, who's created this alter ego called Mischief Eagle Testicle, I think. And so what Ursula Johnson's done is thought, well, what if I were to inhabit this kind of persona that's been important for this artist in kind of indigenous contemporary art, and if I were to adopt this persona, well, what would she look like if she was a soccer mom? And so she made this birch jacket, but it looks like one of those bench jackets.
Oh, that's awesome.
And Gail Tremblay, who's a fantastic artist based in, I think she's in Olympia, Washington. Her gallery is, she's represented by Froelich Gallery in Portland. And so we're very fortunate to have these baskets where she takes recycled film, like 35mm, 16mm moving image film, and weaves them into these incredible baskets using traditional basket weaving techniques. So,
wow. All kinds of cool stuff. Those are all, like, really interesting.
Yeah. Well,
I certainly wasn't expecting any of that when I asked what was coming up.
Yeah, and we got more. We're working on we're opening our summer exhibitions on June the 23rd. So if any of you, if you or your listeners are coming up north of the 49th parallel.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, we come to... my boyfriend and I, we go to Vermont sometimes, and is that on the Ottawa? That comes up to the Canadian border, but I'm not sure exactly where.
It's in Quebec, but I think we're not too far from Montreal. Ottawa is about a 2-hour drive west of Montreal, so okay. Vermont is doable.
Cool.
Yeah.
Maybe one day we'll do it.
Yeah, well, you let me know, and I'll let you know what's going on, and, like, you know, we've got all kinds of neat programming and other things, so
cool.
All of which are listed on our website, and, you know, we're hoping to do even bigger and better things when we're in our new space, which will be in the fall of 2017.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. That sounds amazing. So, well, thank you so much for chatting with me. This was really interesting. I'm so glad I found out about her.
Well, I'm very glad that you asked to chat with me. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm going to sign off right now, but hang on one second. Thank you so much to Michelle Gewirtz of the Ottawa Art Gallery for telling us about the A Window on Pereskova Clark exhibit. And thank you to you for listening. I know I learned a lot. If you're in the Ottawa area, check out the gallery. If you're interested in having us promote your product or service, if you have a comment, if you have ideas for future podcasts, or would like to be on the show yourself, please contact me at arttalkwithbrooke@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.